It's not active. I can play it for you also. It's like lever or lever, but the common usage is octave.
Now, John, let's run it by again. Does your particular dictionary imply that there's more than one possible accepted pronunciation? And in your dictionary, John, do you believe it says octave is acceptable? Over to you, John.
Octave.
KC2WGB, what does your dictionary say if you happen to have looked at it? Over to you, John.
Dictionary.com. You go to the speaker and click on it. It'll tell you it's octave, not octave. But that's like lever and lever. You could pronounce it that way, but the common usage is octave, like eight in Latin.
Well, I can play you both of them. I have American and I have English if you want me to. That's the English.
Octave.
It sounds to me like there's more than one accepted pronunciation. Potato, potato. Tomato, tomato. And so, in many cases, just like engineering is a, or science, let's talk about science. Science is an evolving body of knowledge which is useful to mankind. Evolving, continuously changing. The English language is continuously changing. You listen to Elizabethan language, or you listen to language that was spoken in the English language at the time of Shakespeare. You would barely recognize it. Language continuously changes. So even if the dictionary...
Did you comment about Shakespeare?
Go ahead, John, about Shakespeare.
Who cares how it's pronounced? It means eight. That's all we care about. Eight.
It means speak or write in the contemporary of his time. He used the ancient language, so he wasn't concurrent with the language.
I think it means eight notes on the piano, but it really is a 2-to-1 frequency rejump. A 2-to-1 change in something. An octave is a 2-to-1. A decade is a 10-to-1. There's probably something for 100-to-1, but I can't think of it right now. Okay, we've gone far enough on that one. We're not quite sure of the pronunciation, but we'll be checking on that one. Don, into LDY, go right ahead with your question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, everyone. N2LDY here. I just downloaded, actually, two different apps to my iPhone. They were both under the premise of Gamma Camera. And what this does is it takes the little camera module, your iPhone, and it uses it as a Geiger counter. And the way it does it is really neat. What you do is, well, you download the app and you install it. You put a piece of black tape over your camera. Well, actually, mine has two cameras, so I tape both of them. And when it's running, the little chip inside the camera, you know, that for the pixels, as the gamma ray passes through the pixel, it lights up. You know, maybe it makes a voltage or something, but it activates the pixel. And this thing counts, you know, it has an algorithm that counts the pixels, you know, per minute or something, and it gives you an accurate reading. Really cool app, really fun, and it works great. And I paid $4.99 for the one, but it was worth every penny of it, you know. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, John, that's kind of fascinating. So you're telling me that the charge-coupled device, the array of charge-coupled devices, that's the mosaic, the active film, so to speak, in the back of your electronic camera, is gamma-ray sensitive. Huh. That makes some sense. You've got to be a little bit careful now. All charge-coupled devices that are not being cryogenically cooled do have happen if there was no gamma rays, but there's always some background radiation. In order for you to know that it really was detecting gamma rays, I don't know whether or not a radium dial on a watch gives out gamma rays. There, I'm not sure. But do you think you've got a source of gamma rays where you can actually use the thing and or watch the counts increase when you bring it nearby? That's question number one. And did the application tell you something about sensitivity? Gamma rays are a function of what's the area of the detector, the sensitivity of the detector, the integration time. There's a whole lot of variables involved. But did you actually bring it near something that you believe was a source of gamma rays? Bringing it near the face of a cathode ray tube, of a large color television set, I'm not sure whether or not that would do it. But what did you do to confirm that it was operating, Don? N2LDY, interesting. K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, I think there was somebody else in there too, but okay. The first thing is, so you calibrate it, and calibrate, and then it takes a minute of the background radiation, and then you have some part of that which it you can take select 10 minutes or 10 minutes. And it's data on the background radiation for like 10 minutes. And then it's ready to go. And I tried it with a few different things. I tried it with the element out of a smoke detector. And it was way high compared to the background. I tried it on a radium dial, the old alarm pad. And that was spiking way up there. And I had an old pocket watch too that I tried it on. And I also have some of that depression glass with the uranium in it. That has a much longer, and so I think what I'm going to do tonight is I'll leave it for an hour on background. Let me ask you a second.
Don, you've got to speak a little bit softer. Your louder portions of your voice are jumping out of the machine and you drop out. Back to you, Don.
Background radiation from that. So yeah, it does work. I have tested it. You do calibrate it, and I think it did say something about having to make sure the phone was warmed up or something like that. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's quite far away from the original intent of that machine, your iPhone. How about that? Can you imagine if the people in Fukushima, Japan, after that tsunami and nuclear accident, had those kind of machines in their hand while, I mean, some of those guys really needed a Geiger counter and couldn't get one in time to know what they're being exposed to. That would have been kind of nice to know. Let's see. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, and Wes, N2XJN. Wes, do you have a brief question you can ask at this time? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, from the brief one, I have five because I have five parts. All of them are very short ones. But there is something that I did include in there, which was negative... just a moment, hold on. No, but pick up the other guy, I'm going to be prepared.
Okay, Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, get ready with your question.
Okay, good evening again, thank you, Dick. This question is in purely in respect to AM, amplifying an AM signal. An AM carrier, fully modulated, and correct me if I'm wrong, has two sidebands that are 6 dB below the fundamental carrier power. If you were to measure the carrier power out of a transmitter, say you're doing it through a directional coupling, it's like 30 or 40 decibels down, so you're getting a certain amount of level, not, you know, not actually transmitter power. Measuring, say, with a power meter. How much more of a change would you get, or would you actually see a change on a power meter when you have zero modulation and full modulation being added to the carrier, being that the two sidebands are actually 6 dB down on each side of the carrier? Back to you.
now is a little bit similar to what Rich N2EO was asking last week. And AM modulation is as simple and old as it is, it's still a little bit mysterious. Let me give you an example. All the good books will tell you that full high-level plate amplitude modulation requires an amount of audio power that is half of the RF power. If I've got a transmitter that runs 100 watts of input power to the final stage, and I want to fully modulate it 100% with amplitude modulation, I must generate a audio circuit that can generate 50 watts of audio power. So 50 watts of audio power will, with the right kind of coupling transformer, properly amplitude modulate a 100 watt input power modulated transmitter. I'm using the word input power because that's the old way it used to be measured. And you're measuring input power to the final stage and output power of the audio stage, and the numbers have to come out right before you include the efficiency of the tube itself. I'm avoiding that, as you can tell. Okay. I now look at that transmitter. Before I speak into the microphone, I see 100 watts on the spectrum analyzer. I see 100 watts on my power meter. I now whistle into the microphone, or I turn on an audio signal generator with a 1 kilohertz sine wave. I adjust the amplitude until I hit 100% modulation. On the oscilloscope, if it was a time domain oscilloscope, let me draw. And I'm looking at the voltage coming out of the transmitter. Assume with my coupling network, my oscilloscope probe and whatever, into my ordinary oscilloscope, before I modulate, I see 100 volts on the screen. And now I amplitude modulate with that 100 case, with that 1 kilohertz sine wave out of an audio signal generator. I adjust it so that I, on the time domain oscilloscope, I see it completely pinch off on the lower portion of the modulation. And I will see twice voltage on the upper. In other words, instantaneously, my 100 volts will go to 200 volts, and instantaneously it will go to 0 volts when I'm using 100% amplitude modulation. I look at my spectrum analyzer. I see the 100 watt carrier. I see the upper sideband of 25 watts, 6 dB down. I see the lower sideband, 25 watts, 6 dB down. I have to remember that the upper sideband and lower sideband are coherent with each other. Each one is exactly 1 kilohertz away from the carrier. The two sidebands are 2 kilohertz away from each other, but they're coherent. If I now have a true RMS power meter with the right kind of a coupling circuit measuring the power output, let me drop it. And now I'm jumping over the efficiency of the tube for a minute. Assume that the transmitter really is 100 watts of output. And I've got the right amplitude modulator that can 100% modulate it. It may have taken 150 watts of input power to do that, and 50% of that for the audio, but we won't go there. Assume I've really got 100 watts of output before it's modulated, going into my bird watt meter. Assume my bird watt meter is a true RMS watt meter. Now I turn on the modulation. I've turned on 50 watts of audio. 25 watts upper sideband, 25 watts lower sideband, 50 watts of audio. The true RMS watt meter will read 150 watts. If I'm measuring the current going into the antenna, I will see the equivalent of a current increase, which equals a 50% power increase. And because current is I squared R, it's a square root function, but you know what I mean. So I could measure current going into the antenna, in true RMS. I can measure voltage going into the antenna in true RMS. I can measure power coming out of the transmitter by way of a directional coupler. It will be 50 watts added. It will see 150 watts of average RMS power during the time that 1 KC sine wave single generator is turned on, 100% modulating it. What's really crazy, if I go down to 50% modulation, 50% modulation would be, let me think now, instead of twice voltage up, it'll only be 50% voltage up, 50% voltage down. I'll see something a hell of a lot smaller than the 50 watts of increase. But I should know that one. I don't know it right now. But the main thing you want to know, does amplitude modulation add to power output? Yea, verily. If I was using a very narrow band filter, let me drop
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If I was using a very narrowband filter, and your spectrum analyzer is doing that, if I only look at the center of the screen of the spectrum analyzer, I'm only looking at the carrier power on the analyzer, and although the upper sideband and lower sideband are there, but I'm ignoring them, and I look at only the carrier, or if I do it with a very narrowband filter that passes the carrier and rejects the sidebands, the thing that's hard to believe is that even though your time domain oscilloscope is showing the voltage going to double on the upper part of the modulation and zero on the lower part, the carrier power that you measured through that narrowband filter or on the center of the spectrum analyzer will not change. The carrier, before you modulate, will be 100 watts, and during full modulation, the narrow carrier power stays 100 watts if I have complete linearity of the modulation. Of course, that sounds crazy, but now you've got to be careful how you're measuring power. Are you measuring it across the whole spectrum of what the transmitter is building, is creating? Yes, you'll see 150 watts. If I'm doing a narrowband experiment on only the carrier, I'll see 100 watts with no change. W-H-Y-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
Okay, I was thinking of it like in this fashion. You're using a power meter through a directional coupler. So your 100 watts of power is put 50 dBm, and say you're dropping that down by a factor of 50 decibels through your coupler, so you don't want to damage your instrumentation. So the carrier power, you're reading 0 dBm. And on a spectrum analyzer, you're seeing these two sidebands at full modulation, minus 6 on each side. So if you fully modulate that carrier with modulation, your power meter would now read plus 3 dBm. Would that be correct if I'm understanding you correctly?
I'm working out the mathematics of that right now. 1.5 power increase, log times 10, 1.76. If the power indicating device is a true RMS type, you've got to be careful with that. Many of the things that you measure power with are really a crystal detector where the crystal is working square law. And they recalibrated the screen to take out the square law and tell you what the RMS power is. But many of these crystal detector-like machines tell you exactly the right answer if and only if there is no modulation. If the signal they're measuring is completely steady state, no problem. You start adding a nonlinearity called modulation into a crystal detector, it ain't going to give you true RMS power anymore. But if you're really using a bolometer-type true RMS power meter, you will get a 50% power increase when you fully modulate. That will be a 1.76 decibel increase. If you're measuring decibels, when you add the modulation versus no modulation, 50% power increase, 1.7609 decibels. W-H-Y-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Clear that, because I work with stuff that does that kind of stuff. It's a fairly large amplifying system that amplifies AM, purely AM band signals, and it's designed to be a fairly high power amplifier, and I'm just wondering how this thing reacts if you put a bunch of signals into it and you're trying to keep all the signals, carrier power at 0 dBm, if you're measuring it all collectively that way, how much more the amplitude modulation of each carrier is going to average actually add to this power, and it's so 3 dB looks like the answer of what it's supposed to be.
I don't think I agree. If I measure the power with true RMS measuring equipment and I take a reference reading when the carrier is there and there's no modulation, and then I turn on full sine wave, steady state, in my example, 1kc sine wave, 100% modulation, the RMS power output will be 50% larger. 100 watts will go to 150 watts. A true RMS power indicating device will see 1.76 decibels of increase, not 3 dBs of increase. 1.76 decibels of increase is a 50% power increase. I'm not quite sure why you're calling that 3 dB. The peak envelope power, if you would really measure the peak envelope power, it is twice voltage, it is four times the power, it is 6 decibels of increase of peak envelope power. But across the whole modulation cycle of increase is 50%, 1.76 decibels. WHYYY, KHYYW.
Right, you're right. I was thinking of something else. I'm not sure I was correct with the number 3 dB. Yeah, that sounds like the correct answer there. So I would actually, in a system with a 100-watt amplifier, I should theoretically not see a 200-watt increase with full modulation with all these carriers, but something a lot less than that.
So you got to be careful now. I talked about true RMS power meter, a thoroughly linear, thermally indicating bolometer-like power meter. Many of the power meters you and I can touch these days are really a crystal detector with some kind of a correction curve. So you can end up with numbers that are a little bit different. Second of all, in the real world, rarely do you ever, except doing a test procedure, do you put in a 1 kilohertz steady-state audio sine wave into the microphone circuit of this transmitter. In the real world, you're going to have human beings with speech and music and whatever. Now life gets complicated. Human speech has got a 23 decibel crest factor. In other words, the maximum peak power of the audio I'm putting into this microphone right now is 23 dB louder than the average power of my voice. So in other words, human voice is a very spiky signal. And you try to measure power output of the transmitter during the time that human voice and music is going through it and try to make a guess as to whether or not it's working correctly, that's not easy. If you've got some kind of trapezoid-like oscilloscope looking at the linearity of the amplitude modulation going out to the antenna, yes, you stand a chance. But real speech and what's the average power increase, it's a hell of a lot lower than the 50% increase I just talked about because of the spikiness and the crust factor of human speech. Wonder if that makes some sense, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Okay, well, I guess the final part of this question would be if you're actually looking at the carrier power of a, you know, a regular AM broadcast transmitter, what would you say that the average modulation is going to add to the carrier power in a realistic number if the carrier power is one level compared to, you know, with the carrier having full modulation, music, voice, composition, or whatever?
From the calculation we just did, we know that the maximum increase with pure sine wave, 1KC note, steady state going into the microphone, is a 1.76 decibel increase. And I know that human speech has nowhere near that degree of continuity to it. You look at human speech on an oscilloscope that's sweeping very slowly, it's a very spiky looking signal with blank spaces in between the syllables, in between the words. So with an averaging power meter with speech and or music going into it, I am guessing you're going to see something a little bit less than 1 decibel of increase, not 1.76. And so, to make a judgment of whether or not the transmitter is working correctly, because of the decibels of increase in power you see when a human being speaks into it, that's a tough call. That's not enough information. It's going to take a fancier instrumentation that really looks at the trapezoidal waveform where you display the oscilloscope in such a way that the audio is sweeping you horizontally on the oscilloscope and the RF voltage is sweeping you vertically. Now you can draw a triangular-like diagram on that oscilloscope screen, a light patch that's a triangle-like thing, and depending on the linearity of the envelope of that triangle, you can now make a judgment as to whether or not the transmitter is running with high linearity. That's the easiest way of doing it in the heat of battle. The right way to do it would be a two-tone test where you first do two-tones, low, medium, and high in frequency in the two tones, and look at third-order intermodulation distortion while you're adjusting the transmitter. But that's during the testing procedure. During the real operation, I think the best you can do is a triangular, a trapezoid.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now, I know that Eric has worked at lots of television transmitters where the audio is FM, not AM. I don't know if he has ever worked at an AM transmitter. When it comes to day-to-day confirmation of linearity, I wonder what kind of instrumentation is used. Let's see if Eric's got an opinion on this one. Eric, if you're available, KE2EJ, K2LAW on the deck, man.
KYW.
Final comment. Thank you very much. You can go on to the next person on the tech net. To each worldwide listening.
Okay, I think we've gone down the list of the people who had the early sign-in simple questions, so to speak. Let me make sure I haven't skipped anybody. And if there's no one else, then we'll go to Wesley's deeper subjects. First, is there anyone that we skipped by mistake? Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW. Okay, you got it, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
At first, I had an interesting discussion with WB2KWC, the host of the computer net, and he shared with us his passion of writing some programs, small programs. And then I had a discussion with John. The point is that there is nothing within the reach of ham radio operators, not only, but also with the professionals, that is in regards to the permeability and permittivity. So I asked him, would he be able to write some program? And the basis for that program was actually because of the fact that it requires a very simple set of the equation to just do it. Then we were talking, I believe there was a Glenn with us, we were talking how that could be implemented. John, maybe you recall the basic structure of that interaction.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. What Wesley is trying to achieve, he has several machines that he wants to communicate with. He wants to interrogate the machines, have them perform a function, and then return the results through its math function. And he wants to do that with software. Is that descriptive enough?
Thank you, John. John is always of help to me. I have came across, and I believe I sent you the email on it, the automated measurement of complex permittivity and permeability at high frequencies. And that was the beautiful material developed in 2010 based on the grant from European Union, but it was using a very simple American-made devices. And in it, there is a very simple feature, which is the magnetic holder. It's a capacitive. It's very much similar to the feature of QL bucket with two plates. Now, what it does is you put the sample over there, you can calculate permittivity and permeability. And there are actually three equations that rules with it. The schematic is on it. Let me see if I have it sent to you. Yes, I did. That was part number two, I believe. Hold on. Part number three. Part number three for the TechNet. And there is only one link on it. And I'm going to check if that was the one that I'm reviewing. Yes. Starts with iris.elf.stupa.sk. Now, the thing was that ham radio operators have designed a number of softwares as a shareware, free of charge, and I've been using it for years. Extremely good one. Some of the waterfall, some of the spectrum analyzers, some of them vector network analyzer based on the computer whatsoever. Now, if you recall, Dick, and I believe that you have some knowledge, the old TTL chips with the light, white label on it, and there was something that was burned up into it. Most of the equations that I have in here are very much simple mathematical equations. There is nothing that is really difficult. And it will calculate. I was at first thinking about something, okay, I'm implementing it to the microchip, give the power supply, the input, output, and I'm now able to create the graph on my computer.
That was the first, but John correct me, and then our computer host said, you know, I can try to do it, but then Glenn came up with excellent idea. And Glenn said, you know what, this kind of thing could be done with a spreadsheet. You just implement the spreadsheet into the simple mathematics. I believe that could be done. And if Glenn is there, he could repeat that. That was a brilliant idea. Then everybody could use it. It's free of charge. It will help a lot of people. Now, do you or don't you, Dick, record any device that is within $5,000 that will allow complex of permeability and permittivity to be to be graphed and to exist?
I looked at that particular email that you mailed me a couple of days ago, Wes, which contained a site where when you went through that PDF, you got a document which showed you a vector network analyzer being used to measure complex permittivity and permeability with two different mounting structures. And what a vector network analyzer does in that case is, if, for instance, you sent a signal down a cable that is properly calibrated, and the end of the cable contained a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit, then with reference to the calibration of that cable, 100% of the signal will be reflected from that short circuit or open circuit. Let me drop. And if you've got a fixture at the tail end of that transmission line, which allows you to mount a piece of unknown material, that unknown material, if for instance it is a dielectric material, will have the signal going through it, then hitting the short or the open circuit, whichever is the end of it, and then the signal reflects back through the material a second time. And as such, the vector network analyzer, when the new material is added, compared to the calibration reference reading, it will see a phase delay, which represents the extra velocity factor of the material, and it will see a decrease in signal strength, which represents the loss tangent of the material. So by simply measuring in a vector manner the S11, you can get a pretty good idea of what is the dielectric constant and what is the loss tangent. That is complex permittivity. That's one test procedure. Another test procedure uses the material not in a reflective manner, but in a throughput manner, where you've got two cables, an input and an output cable, coming from the vector network analyzer, sending a signal through. You take a reference reading, and then in the middle of that cable, where the two come together, you add the unknown material, and again you get a delay and a decrease in signal strength. In that case, the signal is only flowing through once versus twice. And in some cases, you get an answer that's more accurate. But by measuring amplitude of what flows through and phase delay of what flows through, knowing the mechanical dimensions of your material, let me drop. The amount of time delay or phase delay tells you something about dielectric constant, which is really velocity factor. And in the case of a coaxial cable, 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant is the velocity factor. And the signal becoming weaker tells you something about the loss tangent, which is the complex component of permittivity. So, a properly programmed vector network analyzer will make all the measurements for you rather accurately, rather automatically. And by way of GPIB, the computer bus that's on many of the Hewlett-Packard and other brand names of vector network analyzer, you can set up what's called ATE, Automatic Test Equipment Program, where the machine runs through the program, makes the measurements, does the mathematics, and displays it for you. That's the good news. That's all doable. There's a catch. Let me drop. The catch is, once you set up that program, it probably is a program fairly specific for a particular vector network analyzer. Within your and my voice, within your and my range where this repeater covers the tri-state area, the total number of radio amateurs who own a vector network analyzer at all. I can probably count them on one hand. The number of guys who own the exact same vector network analyzer might be zero. So that computer program that we're talking about is going to have a fairly narrow application. I'm worried about that a little bit. Second of all, when you and I are choosing materials to build a circuit, if the schematic diagram calls for a piece of Teflon, and we go out and buy a virgin piece of Teflon, we know ahead of time it's dielectric constant, we know it's loss tangent. It's not an unknown material. So for many of the circuits we build, do we really need laboratory instrumentation that measures a material as if it is thoroughly unknown? I know in some cases like you're running into, you might like to measure complex permeability of some of the ferrite materials that are used from a yoke of a television set, for instance, that you're using as a transformer. There, the material might come from a television set that's 20 years old, and its material is unknown if you'd like to make measurements. But to write a program that other people can use who don't have the exact same instrumentation, I see that as a little bit of a problem. N2XJM, K2RIW.
To this point. In one of my computers, I have a program that was designed by ham radio operator to anybody. And actually, set of the programs, that set of the programs gives you ability to work with different kind of professionally found devices. One of the programs is a creation of waterfalls. The other one is spectrum analyzer. Set it up. Then you have a vector analyzer. Now, this ham radio operator made it possible to work with various numbers of Hewlett-Packard advances and other instruments by simply connecting to GPIB by right format of communication. I was using that, and I believe that it wasn't really made for N2XJM, but it was made for everybody else. So my understanding is that if somebody wants to find out the permeability or permittivity or the electric constant, that is not really very much narrow situation. Let me read something for you. The relative permittivity of the material under a given condition reflects the extent to which it concentrates electrostatic lines of flux. And in technical terms, it is the ratio between the amount of electrical energy stored in a material by an applied voltage relative to stored in a vacuum. So, say the ratio of the capacitor using this material as a dielectric compared to the similar capacitor was that has a vacuum as a dielectric. Now we're going that relative permittivity of the material for the frequency of zero is known as a static relative permittivity or dielectric constant. Now, many people have a need to find out what it is a dielectric constant. As a matter of fact, that's the part of my email that I have directed to you, how the dielectric constant change in the medium that is compressible. Anyhow, if I have a radio application that somebody made, that application allows to do the certain measurement, and now I'm trying to create something that is available to everybody, doesn't cost much. Whether I listen to what Glenn say and create it in the spreadsheet with the help of a few guys, or just a simple software that is working with number of different devices, I believe it's a very much helpful tool. So it's not really that I'm concentrated on myself or I need it. No. I believe that we could have some advantages from using such a program, but that's entirely different situation for somebody else who is sitting and watching TV and doing nothing.
analyze the data is a little more difficult than you'd think. Situations, that kind of widget set will actually be cross-platform across Windows, Mac, Linux. Because the reason I bring this up is because I've been trying one of the other people on the web.
My understanding is that we have a typical port. We can use the hyper terminal for it. The transmission was a little bit cut off because you got to start. You're probably transmitting from the walkie-talkie. Now everything starts from the point that we already have a communication with the computer. That would be the easiest one. So if we have a three simple equations, all we need is that instead of doing each point on paper, we're just doing it automatically. And then we're creating the graph. Is it difficult? Yeah, it's Dick.
Chris, when you do come back, you'll have to talk a little bit softer. The machine is very sensitive to overmodulation and it drops out. And you did go through a dropout RF area, so we missed some of what you said. However, I think I got the gist of it. I'm going to also make a point with Wes, and that is, I, for instance, would love to own a real good vector network analyzer that goes to, let me pick a number, 24 gigahertz. And if I'm willing to go out and spend $35,000, I can have one. And maybe I've got the resources, and maybe I can afford it. Maybe I can't. However, a realistic person will say, okay, that's how many dollars I'm investing. How often do I need it? When it comes to me measuring tables and mixers and whatever that I'm going to measure with a vector network analyzer, I might have that need 5 times per year. Does that justify spending $35,000 on an instrument that today cost me $35,000, 10 years from now I can sell it for $4,000 and get some of my money back, as opposed to recognizing that I need that very specific kind of testing 5 times per year. 5 times per year, I either go to a laboratory that is properly equipped, or I go to a friend who owns the instrumentation. I bring him a keg of beer or whatever will please him. I hand him an antenna or whatever. But still, that friend 5 times per year is going to be a lot cheaper than $35,000. So you have to look at the big picture. We can easily fall in love with a very fancy piece of equipment, but how well does it hold its value? How often do you really need it? And we amateurs are so crafty, we can find all kinds of ways around the problem. If I've got an unknown material, do I have to use that material, or can I go out and buy a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Maybe I can go out and buy a known material for that particular application. So, the computer program that does the automation is definitely doable, but very few people own that instrument. Very few people should own that instrument, because it's a very specific thing for a very high, high technology testing. And for what we do in our backyards, I think very few people in the sound of my voice right now have that need. So therefore, this is a difficult one to address from practicality point of view. I wonder if that's some of what you were saying, Chris. I'll speak a little softer, Chris, and maybe you won't drop out. KBQIQN, K2RIW. KBIQN Mobile, K2RIW Fixed. Programmed that properly communicates between a host computer and a piece of automatic test equipment by way of its GPIB bus, Hewlett-Packard interface bus, for instance, a standard, I think it's called 1988 GPIB, something like that, it's got a name for it. Anyhow, it takes a lot of, you better be a person who really likes writing computer programs, because you're going to spend a lot of time doing it and debugging it. And do we really need it that often? And how many people own that exact piece of instrumentation where that program is compatible with? The right computer, the right network analyzer, the right interface program, and the real need. I think we're getting into a very narrow band application here, Wes. And so other than for you to measure the specific characteristics of that particular piece of ferrite that you're winding your coil on, to go to the right laboratory and have that directly measured, rather than buy the test equipment to do it. One might be more practical than the other, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure all of what you're doing and how many coils you've got to measure. And 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2XJN, yeah. Well, from one point you're right. I mean, if I was to really measure this particular ferrite of my interest, exactly this one, the money is not important, I'm not paying anything, and if the guy has to put in his hundreds of thousands of dollars, he's going to put it. John knows what I'm talking about. So, yes, I do have a resources. If I really want to, I do have a resources for that ferrite to be examined to the crystalline structure. But, since Glenn came with the very nice idea, and since I didn't get the answer of one question, I believe this is kind of doable. The question is, do you or don't you, Dick, see a device that will do the measurement of permittivity and permeability? Or do you know of anybody who has such equipment or anybody who makes such equipment? Because, obviously, I don't. It's a black hole. And to exist.
Okay. Do I know of anybody who owns the equipment? The closest thing I know of anybody in the tri-state area is John, KC2WGV. He owns a vector network analyzer with the right kind of fabricated fixture for mounting the unknown material. He, in theory, could make the measurement. There is another way. A poor man's equivalent of a vector network analyzer is an antenna analyzer. An antenna analyzer does put power at various frequencies into your antenna, and it does measure standing wave ratio. It does measure reflection coefficient. When it's measuring that reflection coefficient, you are getting both a phase angle and an amplitude. From that phase angle and from that amplitude, you can calculate what is the complex permittivity or complex permeability of that particular material. Yes, I'll admit that the antenna tuner, the antenna analyzer being used in that manner, is probably only going to give you 1.5 decimal places of accuracy. But in some cases, that's good enough. You do have to worry about something that you just mentioned. Let me drop for a second. And that is that the complex permittivity and complex permeability do both change as a function of frequency. The most extreme example that was given in the article that you gave me was water. At most RF frequencies, water, pure water, has a dielectric constant of about 80 or 81. As you go to higher frequencies or you go to higher temperatures, the water goes to lower dielectric constants. By the time you get all the way up to a electromagnetic frequency that's very high, that you and I call light, at light frequencies, water has a dielectric constant of 1.7, even though it was 80 at RF frequency. So, like many materials, it's a function of frequency. It changes considerably, both loss tangent and dielectric constant, permeability and permittivity. They all change versus frequency. But a antenna analyzer, you buy the right one, It is a poor man's equivalent of a vector network analyzer. It's only a couple hundred dollars, nowhere near as accurate, but in, used in a crafty manner, I think it could measure what you want to measure at ham radio frequencies. N2XJN, KQLIW.
Yeah, okay, N2XJN. Now you can understand what I'm saying. I have Advantis R3267, which is probably 100 times faster than John's network analyzer, but it covers only 150 megahertz, which is good for me. But I was asking about the device that is made for permeability and permittivity to measure. So far, it looks like it is a black hole. There is no devices, nobody makes them, although the people need them. I mean, you would like to know what is the dielectric constant of whatever is of interest to you, but you don't have a device to measure it that is ready out of the shelf. So, such a program or such an addition to that, like the one that was made with the article that I gave you, is simply something that people use. I don't have the access to that software, that's why I came with the idea to just write one. But two.
And two LDY.
I went away to find the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation magazine. I thought I had an issue in a particular shelf which has on almost every single issue the name of a company that measures, that sells you the test fixture that allows you to measure complex permittivity and permeability. Every single issue of his Antennas and Propagation magazine has this machine. It's got a Greek name, Omega Sigma or something like that. I can't think of the name of the dot company. But there is a company that sells you the test fixture, if that's what you want, Wes. Into XJN, K2LIW.
It's Omega. Again, what is the model? What is, how can I find it?
Okay. If you stand by for about 2 minutes, I'll find an issue, and I'll find you the name of the company. And by the way, they sell a whole series of test fixtures. You can get from this company a test fixture that allows you to make the measurement at 1 megacycle, another fixture that allows me to make the measurement at 1 gigahertz, another fixture that will allow you to make the measurement at 50 gigahertz. They sell a whole series of test fixtures, depending on what size of material, whether it's a permittivity or permeability material, and what frequency range you want to measure it at. I didn't say they're cheap, but this company has them. And because it's a fairly rare item, I'm a bit worried that you're not going to be able to find one of these on the surplus market, and to buy it outright, I think it's going to be a bit pricey. I'm going to go away for a couple of minutes and find you an issue, and I'll get you that name of that company. K2LIW, you got it, Wes.
Thank you very much, Dick, for your effort. Yeah, also I wonder why most of the devices related to permeability and permittivity start from 300 kilohertz. Some of them from 30 kilohertz, but why is the frequency range not covering the lower part of it? Also, as far as the vector network analyzer, they don't go really very low. I was lucky to have one that started from 9 kilohertz, but it looks like most of them, they do the measurement from 100 kilohertz. John has a beautiful device, but that one, as far as the...
Repeater, timeout.
So which we're waiting for the pick up, please.
Yeah, out of curiosity, what is the frequency that you're looking to measure on the this ferrite core? I mean, what is the frequency that you're interested in? Is my question to you.
Basically, I'm not interested in the frequency. It's a frequency range. I'm trying to have a scope of the values that will give me a permeability at given region. So let's say if I have permeability of 3,000 and I'm able to calculate, I know that this definitely works in lower range of the frequencies, starting from the hertz up to, let's say, a few kilohertz, sometimes 20 kilohertz. So then the lower the permeability, then the higher the frequency of operation of particle ferrite, if there is a ferrite. But that will also be related to the materials on this, not the devices on this, to which that would be a powder or whatever else is there. We have a cockroach actually in infesting the technet right now.